welcome to episode 20 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, how are you, Perry?
Pretty good, thanks. Pretty good. Before we get started, David, I believe both of us have got a bit of a fix-up for something that we said last week. I know I certainly have. It was in regards to when we were talking about films, and I was talking about the film Knives Out. And this just gives the indication to our listener that I actually listen to some of the episodes from time to time. Not necessarily all of it, but I get to it all in the end. It's just a matter of when I get time. But the program, the fix I've got, I want to make is that when I was talking about the film Knives Out, I was speaking about one particular actor whose name escaped me at the time, who I said was playing against type, and that he had played Captain Marvel in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That was completely wrong. His name is actually Christopher Evans, and he played Captain America. Now, I reckon, in my dotage, the problem is that I'd already spoken about the film Captain Marvel, and I just kept on having that in my head. And so when Captain came up, the next word that popped out of my mouth was Marvel, but it was incorrect. So what I was, what should have said was that I was really impressed with Christopher Evans, and he seemed to have a really good time making it and playing against type that he had done in all the Marvel movies. So that's me, Dave.
There you go. That's good. Well, mine was really just not so much an error as an omission. It was in our episode, I think, which was 18, where we were talking about the best of. And I totally managed to forget to mention in my best of literary category a book called The Choke by Sophie Laguna, which was in my top five. And so I won't go into any detail about that now, but that was something I meant to talk about and didn't. And the other thing is that when I was talking about the best TV I'd seen, I also forgot to mention the fact that I saw during 2019, I watched both season three and season four of The Expanse, which on Amazon Prime, and that was very enjoyable. So I should have mentioned those. That's me.
All right. Okay, well, for today, we're going to get on to talking about things that we've been reading lately in just a minute. Later on, we'll be running an interview that I conducted with Lucy Sussex about a book that I listed as one of my best non-fiction for 2019, that is The Shelf Life of Zora Cross. So that's a biography that Lucy and I are going to chat about coming up. We'll have that after we've discussed what it is we've been reading lately. Later on, we'll also have something else, and we'll give you some details right at the end of the program about what we've got coming up, because yes, listener, we do actually have a few plans. Mm-hmm. We've actually got some stuff in the can and a lot of plans about what it is we're going to be talking about. And as we keep on discussing what it is we're going to be talking about, we keep on filling out more and more program ideas about what we can do. And sooner or later, somebody's got to have to put a brick on top of our heads to slow us down. But anyway, we'll see how we get to. So, David, what have you been reading lately?
Well, I've read a lot over the last month. I've actually read 11 books, as I see you have, during January. So, for me, that's a real record.
So, you said that you've read 11 books this month. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's unusual for me. Yeah, certainly I've been cracking the pace with this bit of a reason for it, which we'll come to probably next episode. But I'm not going to talk about all 11 books, but I thought I would talk about Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe, which has been a little bit controversial, certainly in right-wing circles. I'm not really sure why. I think the people who have objected to it haven't read the book. It's really about the state of Aboriginal culture at the time at which the explorers and the first settlers arrived in Australia. And he makes it very clear, so it's a very well-researched book. And he's quoting, literally quoting from the original explorers' journals and from the diaries and so on of settlers, early settlers. And it's clear from that that the impression we have of Aboriginal people just being mere nomads, hunter-gatherers who wandered over the landscape and didn't have any permanent settlements and didn't really have much in the way of technology is really quite wrong. All of those early accounts do report that Australian Aborigines did have stone huts in many places. They built quite extensive structures like fish traps. They had quite sophisticated methods of catching fish. They harvested the land in all sorts of ways. They harvested huge quantities of grain from grasses and milled it. And this is all, I say, absolutely from the original sources of, the journals of these explorers. So it's, it really shouldn't be contentious. But of course, the reason that the right-wing people are upset about it is that it goes against the idea that Australia was terra nullis, an empty land that was just ripe for Europeans to exploit and to take over, and they didn't need to feel guilty about stealing the land from the Aborigines. And so it's a very interesting book. I do recommend that anyone who's Australian read it and go from there.
It strikes me that this has got echoes with another book from another continent, a book called The Lost City of Z or Z, depending on what continent you come from, by a writer called David Gran. It was actually made into a film recently. I haven't seen it, unfortunately. You know, it's one of those things that every now and again something pops into your head and you think, oh, I was supposed to watch that. Anyway, so David Gran talks about a particular explorer from the early 1900s who was a member of the Royal Society in the UK, and he had this theory that prior to the arrival of the Europeans in South America, so the Spaniards coming in, mm-hmm. that there was a vast empire centered around the Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody believed him. Everybody thought it was a lot of cobblers and thought that, you know, he was just talking out of his hat. So he went off to try to do some expeditions. He found some things which were looking very promising. He went back a couple of times, and then finally he went back with his son and his son's best friend, and they were lost and never heard from again. This book, Lost City of Zed, is David Gran's idea of trying to track him down. The main character actually became a model for Arthur Conan Doyle's explorer for, you know, the land that time forgotten, all that sort of stuff. So all those books that he wrote, and since he did the work, and since this book has come out, it really is obvious that there really was a very big civilization in the Amazon that has been completely lost and completely forgotten again, probably for similar reasons. In the sense that, well, we didn't want them to have that particular civilization, so if we write it out of the history and completely ignore it, it'll just go away.
Yes.
Well, things don't.
No.
And there's also a report just recently that some of those things that you were talking about, some of those eel traps fishing traps and stone huts and some of the foundations have become more visible again after the bushfires.
Yes.
So there's been a couple of reports of that happening just recently. So, but this is really blown up a big minefield, hasn't it?
It certainly has.
Been a lot of politicization of this whole thing over the last few weeks.
It's because the right wingers don't want to believe it. That's the point. They don't want to accept that. The other thing that's worth mentioning, of course, is that the age of the indigenous culture here in Australia, there's good archaeological evidence that shows that the Aboriginal communities go back something like 50 or 60,000 years. And they were living sustainably in this continent for this extraordinary period of time, which is far longer than any European civilization has been able to last. And yet they had this pretty much steady state. And that's one of the things I think that people object to is that, oh, there was no progress. There was no progress happening. And maybe there wasn't a lot of progress happening, but they'd reached this self-sustaining, stable system that kept going for literally tens of thousands of years. And so it's really quite extraordinary.
Yeah, it's certainly a book that I need to read. It'll be very interesting to watch what happens with Dark Emu. Mm. It was a bit of a sleeper when it first came out because it's been out three or four years.
It has. The one I read was a revised edition, yeah.
And I think it's just since it's been a revised edition, it's starting to pick up a lot of traction, and that which is good to see. And I think that I'm always of the view that those people that are easily upset should be upset more often. And if the right wing commentariat basically wants to get upset about all this, well, great. Yep. it's excellent. Well, I'll take over. Yeah, I'll do one now.
Sure.
Mine's a science fiction novel, debut novel from 2019. I had never heard of this guy, never heard of this particular book until I went to a meeting of the Nova Mob in December. Now, for those who don't know, the Nova Mob is a Melbourne-based science fiction discussion group that meets once a month, first Wednesday of the month, I think, and has been running for something like 40 years. One of the people that presents on a yearly basis, and he always does it at the end of the year, because he picks out his best books that he has read for the year, this particular person that presented is Ian Mond. He's a reviewer for Locus magazine, with the newspaper of the science fiction world. So he's doing a lot of reviewing over a lot of period of time. So he's reviewing that, and he picks those books that are around the edges of the genre. The list that he gave didn't really have anything like a planetary romance or a space opera or any of that sort of stuff. All of his stuff is around the edges of the genre. So it's sort of like it's almost mainstream with a touch of the genre in it. And one that he really particularly liked, which is probably a bit more into the field than a lot of the others, which is probably why I decided I wanted to read it, was a book called Infinite Detail by Tim Maughan. Now, this is a novel that is set slightly into the future. You don't know exactly how much into the future, but it's told in two particular timelines, one called before and one called after. The event that the two timelines are before or after is the complete and utter destruction of the internet. Now, the book doesn't go into any great detail about how that occurs, and I really don't care. It doesn't really matter. Some people might get nitpicky and say, oh, well, you've got to give us all the detail. Well, no, you don't. It's just basically there's a collective that are working in a zone in Bristol in the UK called The Croft. In this particular place, and this is in the before timeline, in this particular place in the Croft, they have been able to get to the point where they have completely shut off the internet from the outside world and have their almost internal LAN internet running. That works very, very well for them because they want to basically get away from all of the problems associated with the internet. But somebody sort of infiltrates and realizes that they can utilize that closed off particular area to send out a virus that is going to attack the internet and blast it out. The after section of the after timeline deals with what happens 10 years after the event. And you get these two timelines running interchangeably. So you'll get one chapter of the before, one chapter of the after. And you start to get the realization of how the two of them are coming together and what's happening in the before is impacting on what's happening in the after. And then you start seeing the connections. It's really well done. It's really well written. It's an excellent book. I found the first 20 or 30 pages really difficult to get into. And it took me a while to figure out why. And I realized I was reading this on an e-books version. And I think that if I'd been reading it on a paper version, I would have gone, now, what the hell is he talking about? Flip, 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 go back to that. Oh, that's right. Then come forward again. It's a lot easier to do that on paper than it is to do it in an e-book format. And I think I struggled a little bit for that. But once I got rolling after 30 or 40 pages, it just goes. And this is really quite an excellent book. Mm. It is going to be on my Hugo ballot for this year. Can't see that I'm going to be reading five or six books that are going to be better than this, that are going to knock it off. I think you need to keep an eye on it because it will be there or thereabouts in the awards for this year. If it's not, I'll be really annoyed. If it's not, it will probably only be because Tim Maughan's not known and he's British. Mm. And not enough people who are nominating in the US may have seen it. Mm. Hopefully it will get picked up. I know that both Ian Mond, who reviewed it, really liked it. Jonathan Strawn, who's from Perth, who is the reviews editor for Locus, picked it as his staff pick for the year. So hopefully, because it's got two different recommendations from people, that it will get picked up. And I would recommend that people read it.
I'll look for that. The next one on my list of what I've read so far is Normal People by Sally Rooney. Now, this is a non-genre novel, whatever you like to call it. It's not fantasy or SF or anything. I think the title is really interesting because it's about a couple of young people who are not really normal, but in some ways would like to be normal and ordinary. They'd like their lives to be more normal. So there's this kind of constant play of these extraordinary people who are both very, very clever. And you sort of wonder, you know, maybe is everyone extraordinary? Is no one normal? So that's kind of quite nice. So this really starts with a couple of young people. A young man called Connell, whose mother is the cleaner at a sort of mansion somewhere in Ireland near Dublin. And he visits sometimes to pick up his mum from this mansion where she's been cleaning. And there's a young girl, Marianne, there, who's also in his class at school. And so they kind of get to talking to each other, and he's a very, very popular young man at school. He's handsome, he's good at sports, everybody likes him. She, on the other hand, is very unpopular. She's not particularly pretty. She doesn't get on with the other girls at school. None of the boys like her. Nobody's gone out with her, but this relationship nevertheless builds between these two people. And the problem is that Connell kind of doesn't want to admit to the relationship. He's embarrassed by this situation because his mother works for this fairly rich family, of which Marianne is the daughter. And so he kind of doesn't want to let people know that it's going on. He doesn't want anyone to know that he's actually building up a relationship with this girl which eventually becomes an intense sexual relationship. And so that goes on for quite some time, and he kind of lets her down inadvertently, hurts her in all sorts of ways. And then when they leave school, both of them go to Trinity College in Dublin, and there things are kind of reversed. He's the not-so-popular guy. She becomes accepted by a crowd of very popular people and becomes very popular herself, gets another boyfriend, but eventually comes back to Connell. So it's an interesting story, this interplay between the two characters, and it goes on and on, and they have very many ups and downs, very, very many ups and very many downs in their relationship throughout the book. So it's one of a number of awards, I think. It was long listed for the Booker a few years ago, but it's certainly been well recommended by people, and I would certainly recommend reading it too.
All right. Yes, I've seen that book. I've seen that book around quite a bit. A lot of people are talking about it.
Yeah.
My second one is actually the second volume in the Annals of the Western Shore cycle, Voices by Ursula K. Le Guin. You may remember that I discussed the first book in this trilogy called Gifts. It was one of my best of the year for young adult fiction for last year. This is the second book. It doesn't follow directly on from the first one. I believe there are some characters in this that either have connections to or appeared in the first one, but they are minor. But this one's basically, this one's very interesting for Le Guin. It's set in a town of, a fictional town in a fictional country, in a fictional world, doesn't matter, but it's completely fictional, town of Ansel, which has been invaded by a neighbouring country, the Alds, who have imposed a political or religious system on the town that bans books and forces women out of the public eye. So they have to stay at home. They're not supposed to be out walking around anywhere. So there's a bit of, you can get a metaphor here about some religious things, but, and what few books have been left have been stored in a waylord's house for safekeeping. What's happened is that he's been the one that has been the spokesperson for the group for the town for a long period of time. He was tortured by the Alds when they first came in and fairly badly disfigured. And then when he didn't reveal where any of the books were, they would basically let him go. But he has all of the books stored in the back of his house, which only he and a young girl have access to. And you get the feeling that he doesn't feel as though he's got terribly much longer to live because of the torture, the effects of the torture that he's undergone, and that he's trying to bring this young girl up to become the waylord and take over after him, because she's got a very deep interest in books and is reading a lot of them. And as she says, at times they seem to talk to her. The whole political and religious climate of this particular town is thrown into a bit of turmoil when an uplands poet comes to the town. Now, the Alds like storytelling, but they don't like books. They're afraid of books. They think books are evil or whatever. But they like people to be able to follow the oral tradition of being able to give long, detailed descriptions of poetry and stories and tell a long story. They love it. They think it's absolutely fantastic, but they don't like the written word. And so this poet comes in and he's very much on the idea that, of course, he wants to be able to find books, to be able to read new stories so that he doesn't have to make them up himself, because otherwise he's just hearing and reciting things that he's already heard previously, and he wants to continually get new material all the time. So he's of the view that maybe there are books in this town, but he's very reticent to say anything because he's having to deal with the oppressors to give recitals for them. He's also having to he's living in the Waylord's house, and the Waylord's trying to keep him separated from this whole idea of books and not mentioning them at all. It's a fantastic view of what happens to a community when their literary tradition is taken away from them, and what happens to the way they act and what they do and the lengths they'll go to try to maintain that literary tradition. It's got echoes of The Telling, a book by Le Guin from her Hainish cycle, which had something relatively similar, and also has echoes, I believe, of Fahrenheit 451. And I think that Le Guin had the Bradbury novel in mind when she wrote both of these books. It really gives me the feeling that with this particular book, Voices, that she felt there was something left over from The Telling. I've got to work out which order they come in, but it's two sort of parts of the whole story, and they tell slightly different approaches to this idea of maintaining a literary tradition under oppressive foreign political influence. Excellent stuff. Hmm. Really, really good. It's going to be on my best of the year YA books. Okay. So there we are, two already. I've got one in the SF list, and I've now got one in the YA list, and I've only gone through a month of the year.
You never know. You may come across something even better.
You never know. But again, I'd have to do pretty well to read five good big YA novels to knock that one off the list.
Sure. All right.
So have you got another one?
This will be the last one I'll talk about for this episode. And this is really a novella. Certainly, it's really the length of a novella. In fact, I borrowed a copy from the local library, and the only copy they had was in a large print edition. So that was nice for my eyes, but it shows you that it really wasn't a very long book. And that was called The Blind Contessa's New Machine by Kerry Wallace. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't heard this one.
I'm not sure where I picked up the recommendation for this, but anyway, it had an intriguing title, and I thought I'd follow it up. And it really is a very nicely written book. And it's really, that's the story. It's about this young woman in Italy in about the 1800s, and she's just about to get married. And she starts to realize that she's starting to go blind. And she's going blind from the edges outward, from the edges inward, if that's the right way of expressing it. So the edges of her vision start to go, and she progressively gets narrow and narrow until she can only see through sort of a tunnel. And in fact, when she sort of tells her parents that this is happening or that she's starting to go blind, nobody pays her any attention and doesn't sort of believe her. And indeed, when she says that to her fiancé, who she's about to get married to, that she's going blind, he thinks she's just playing a game and doesn't understand. But what's interesting is that there's another character who's a slightly older man than her, who's an inventor. And before she gets married, he strikes up a relationship with her, and intellectually they bond far more closely than she and her fiancé does. And he gives her all the sympathy that she needs about the fact that she's going blind. But anyway, she eventually marries the young count, her marriage isn't particularly happy, and she ends up with having an affair with this inventor chap, which is interesting because she's totally blind at this point, and so how she manages to have secret assignations with this guy is quite interesting. But he eventually builds her a machine. He's always building these crazy machines, flying machines, for goodness knows what, thinks he's trying to build these things. And he eventually builds her like a prototype typewriter so that she can write letters. And it's very, very simple, very crude and very simple, but it lets her actually type out letters to people. And so that's the new machine. So it's a really interesting story. And it's quite a sad story. There's no happy endings to it. But it's very touching and very romantic and well written. So it was worth following up just on the basis of the title. So that was okay. That's three good books I read this month.
All right. Well, after a couple of crackers, I'm going to come to one where I was really ambivalent about. This is Amsterdam by Ian McEwan. It's a non-genre because it won the 1999 Booker Prize. This is a short novel, and one of the reasons why I've read McEwan in the past is that he's one of these characters that came out of the UK mainstream in the, what was it, late 70s, early 80s, around the time of Martin Amis, Julian Barnes, that sort of crowd. He was sort of, there was sort of tinges of the macabre and sort of almost fantastical stuff that he was writing. Not to the extent that there was any fantasy involved in it. It's just that some of the techniques that he used and some of the themes that he covered in his novels really were stuff that could have almost fitted into the genre. You know, the things like The Comfort of Strangers and The Innocent and The Cement Garden, those sorts of things, which are some of them really quite nasty books. Anyway, he'd been one of these guys that had been floating in and around the literary scene for a fair bit, and he was in right in the middle of it all, and he puts this book out called Amsterdam. It came up in a year where it was up against not really a great shortlist, which is possibly why it was chosen as opposed to any of the others. I've only read one of the others, Master Georgie by Beryl Bainbridge, which I read end of last year, and that was like, yeah, so-so. Wasn't really anything terribly flash. So I picked this one up. I believe I'd read it once before, and I seem to recall that the responses to this particular book weren't all that good when it came out, but I thought I'd try it again. The first 100 pages of this are fantastic. Really, really good. Basically, two men who are old friends meet at the funeral for this woman, Molly Lane. She's died quite young, and they were both ex-lovers of hers. One of them, Clive Linley, is a composer working on a big millennial symphony, because this is 1997, 98 that it was written, so millennial was all the rage at that stage, completely and utterly forgotten now, of course. And the other one, Vernon Halliday, is a magazine editor who's been promoted in the magazine to try to get the magazine up to higher circulation standards, because it's basically coming apart and it's losing out to all the scandal sheets. They find that the husband of the woman that died has found some photographs, compromising photographs, of the current foreign secretary. And the husband gives them to Vernon Halliday, well, actually sells them to him, with the understanding that all of these three guys all hate the foreign secretary because they think he's a nutcase, and they're quite happy to bring him down. So that's all a nice setup, and all things sort of move along very well. And then just as you think things are going to be move along, McEwan just lets the book go off into a weird, weird approach. The characters start doing things that don't appear to be consistent with the way they were acting before. They seem to turn from what they were doing into, I don't know, just unintelligent, boring people. And so that after about 120 pages, the book's only about 175 pages long, it just literally falls off the cliff and it just becomes terrible. 100 pages in, I was almost willing to give this 5 stars. By the time I got to the end of it, I could barely give it 3.
That's interesting.
So it's just astounding in terms of how it just comes apart. And I don't know what he did, but I think he got to the point where halfway through, he just decided he hated these people. I mean, he'd be poking a bit of fun at them as he was going through, as he generally does with his characters. But I think in the end, he just got to the stage where he absolutely hated them and then just tried to get them to a situation where lots of bad things happened to him. An interesting read for not the normal reasons. It's short. You can read it in a day and have a look at it. People may feel, oh, no, I'm completely missed the whole point and everything sort of made sense and it all floated along very nicely. I didn't.
It didn't do it for you.
So why it won the Booker Prize? Don't know. Yeah, but no. There we go.
Okay, interesting, interesting.
So we all basically read some interesting books, and one of the interesting ones that I read, as I said earlier, at the end of last year, was The Shelf Life of Zora Cross. As I said then, it was one of those biographies that I really like to discuss with somebody else. So I contacted Lucy Sussex and see whether she was interested in discussing it. And what follows is the interview.
Excellent.
Over a period of 3 years, from 1916 to 1918, the Australian poet Zora Cross published four collections of poetry. Her second, Songs of Love and Life, sold out its first edition in 3 days. Cross's star was in the ascendant. George Robinson, of Angus and Robinson publishing fame, thought of her as one of Australia's greatest ever poets. And yet, two decades later, she was hardly being published, and a century later, she's all but forgotten. So what happened? Why the fall from grace into obscurity? In her biography of the author, The Shelf Life of Zora Cross, Kathy Perkins attempts to make some sense of Cross's life and how it intersected with others in Sydney's literary community in the first half of the 20th century. I read the book at the end of 2019 and placed it in my list of best non-fiction of the year. But with all biographies, there are always some itches that cannot be fully scratched, questions that seem only partially answered, and some topics that need to be discussed with another reader. And who better to discuss the book than author, Australian literature historian, and friend of the podcast, Dr. Lucy Sussex. I talked to Lucy recently, and I started by asking her what she knew of Zora Cross prior to reading this book.
I knew the name, and that was about it. Because
I'm disappointed in you, Lucy.
I know a bit about 20th century Australian novelists, and I know more about 19th century novelists, but poets is kind of a grey area in my education.
Well, fair enough. She did. She has, of course, written half a dozen, 10, 12 novels. Yes, oddly enough. I'm not sure it really... There's a little bit in there about the book about her novel writing, but it's mainly about the poetry. So you knew a little bit about her. Did you know her connections to anybody?
Well, she's part of the Sydney scene, so she would have met a whole lot of interesting people. And, in fact, that's partly how this book is structured, her encounters with other people, which is a very interesting approach to take, because it's not a straight chronological birth, life, death, which is normally what... Normally, I can imagine an editor or a publisher's readers saying, put this in chronological order. And, well, it does follow that loosely, but it's more about the relationships she has. So it's arranged thematically by people, even if the association was brief, like Norman Lindsay, who famously... objected to her poetry, or rather its sensuousness.
Oh, the prat. He was an idiot, wasn't he, in that regard?
Bit of a dirty old man.
Well, here he is, a man that basically sort of doing all of those drawings and paintings about nubile young women in the nude. And here we have a poet who's writing from the heart about her sexual feelings as well as everything else, and he doesn't like it.
Well, possibly he feels threatened by it because he's a very conventional 19th century bloke underneath the bohemianism.
Oh, I think you're right.
But I'd say actually for most of her early life she is a bohemian. She leads a bit of a wild life.
She does.
And at the same time producing poetry, and yet then settles down as a Blue Mountains mother and still keeps on writing, and, you know, she's Mrs. This and perfectly respectable lady, but like many, I suspect, older women, she's had a bit of a wild past.
Well, there's a lot of that in this particular book. But let's get back to the structure of this book, because I'm really quite interested in how this was done. And as you said, it is written in a series of chapters that are overlapping chronologically, where the biographer has taken her interactions with various people in the literary field, starting with Ethel Turner, and running through people like Mary Gilmore, Norman Lindsay, as you said, George Robinson, who we'll get to a bit later on, David McKee Wright, who's a big piece of her life, of course, and which we'll also get to, and John Le Gay Brereton. So I thought it was very interesting, and the overlapping way that it runs. You could, if you like, feel as though there are times when you can get a little bit lost in that it doesn't as follow the standard biographical cycle of starting at the beginning and working your way through. But I think this is, in the end, it's worked out pretty successfully. And it gives you a really good overview, as you said, of the Sydney literature scene between about early 1900s to about mid-1930s, and then peters out a bit going up into the 1940s.
Well, because she's getting on a bit, and she's not writing as much as she used to. I think, yes, it gives a really good view of the Sydney literary scene. It's sort of looking back into the past, you know, with mention of people who were major writers before she hit the scene, as in Henry Lawson at his peak, who also had a slightly troubled relationship with George Robertson. They all felt George Robertson let them down. But, you know, that was interesting that she was holding out for her copyright. And, you know, she was a businesswoman as well as a poet. Even if she didn't manage her literary heritage as well as someone like Banjo Paterson, who was a businessman to his bootstraps.
And a lawyer, so he knew basically what he had to do to basically keep all of his contracts and all of his literary heritage all together in one place, where a lot of the other
bohos,
new or jobbing poets, if you like, you know, basically, and I don't mean that in a bad way, because these people were trying to earn a living by writing on a regular basis for a large number of newspapers and magazines that were being published in and around Sydney, but also in the Australasian down in Melbourne. So she was getting putting her material out into a lot of different places.
Yeah, this is the thing about syndications, which was the idea that somebody's work would be reprinted in country newspapers, and this is a good summing up of the whole syndication thing, that it got people's writing out to a whole lot of readers who otherwise would miss it. And so it would be that somebody in Sydney would prepare a literary supplement of selected poets, short stories, whatever, and then they'd send it out to the country newspapers, who'd pay them a fee for using it. And this meant that they weren't using overseas material, which is more expensive. And it was a good way by which authors could earn extra dosh. And I think it's very important for Australians, given the tyranny of distance. So there's an excellent explanation of how that worked and how she benefited from it, and realising that, yeah, you could just about keep afloat by writing for different publications all over Australia.
But you had to really keep at it. This was a full-time job. If you didn't work at it continuously and have poems in just about all the weekly newspapers at least once a month, you were going to struggle, I think.
Yeah, you had to keep up the flow, and I've been looking at Mary Fortune, who did much the same thing in the 19th century, and the amount of her stuff, you know, monthly publications, but then other bits and pieces elsewhere. It was economic necessity. But then you think in England, I think it was Penelope Fitzgerald's father who earned a living writing comic poetry for the likes of Punch and other magazines. Yep. So it wasn't unheard of when there was a big readership for magazines and everybody read the Bulletin and the Australian Journal.
Oh, if you go back through a lot of the early poetry from the late 1880s through to about the 1930s, and you do look at a lot of the newspapers, you come across these people like, you know, Roderick Quinn and Mabel Forrest and Zora Cross to some degree, who are basically everywhere. They're all over the place. They're turning up everywhere, all over the place. Now, some of the material they wrote was good. Some of it was just sort of average. But Zora Cross really hit the big time early with a couple of her first collections of poetry, namely, and the major one being Songs of Love and Life, which is the one that we were alluding to about her erotic poetry, which Norman Lindsay had trouble with. George Robinson didn't want it originally and then saw that it was published as a private printing and then took it on and ran with it. And so they had a... He was a major, almost father figure in her life for a long period of time, wasn't he?
Well, I think he was one of these good, brilliant publishers who cultivated relationships with their authors, and it wasn't two, one book and you're out. You know, they could see that somebody could... You could start with one book and then lead onwards. The slight difficulty that Cross had was that her first book and a couple of them were did very well and then other ones didn't, so he lost interest in her.
Mm.
And so, you know, that was a kind of trajectory which was unfortunate, but he thought she'd done her dash.
I think she had a much more detailed view or view of depth of their relationship than he did. He was trying to bring her along as a poet to keep her in the publishing house so that he could earn money from the publications. And she saw something a lot more in the relationship. And I don't mean this was a sexual relationship. I mean more as an emotional relationship where she basically really needed somebody who could understand what she was getting at and encourage her and bring her along. And as you say, when things started to go not quite right between the two of them, he seems to have almost dropped her like a hot spud.
Well, I think this is a professional thing. You can't really be friends with your publisher and your editor and or your agent because the business relationship can get in the way. And maybe I think he's one of those Australian men who sort of retreats from emotions and thinks that she's coming on a bit strong.
Okay. Yeah, well, I suppose my, if I had one quibble with this particular book, it would be that I thought that breakup of the, or the slow disintegration of the relationship between Cross and George Robinson was the major, one of the major two points of her life, the other one being her relationship with David McKee Wright. And he dies young. He dies in the mid-20s. So she's left for the last 40 years of her own, of her life as a widow. But the breakup of, or the disintegration of that relationship with George Robinson, I think might needed just a little bit more explanation. Did you find that it was covered sufficiently, did you think?
Well, it was... We're all very pleased as, well, that as... Literary scholars are delighted that Angus and Robertson kept such good records, and so you can see Banjo Paterson checking his royalties and actually putting a stamp there to indicate that he's checked his royalties. You know, this wonderful archive that doesn't exist for other things like the Australian Journal. But, of course, there's gaps. There's unseen material. And, you know, I'm just speculating when I say that, you know, he doesn't really want to be friends with his authors unless, you know, it's a bloke that he can go down to the pub with and have a beer. And this rather intense woman, perhaps he's, you know, wants to keep her at arm's length, but that's pure speculation. It's just not there. I think she's lucky that she hits upon a kindred soul in David McKee Wright because he understood what she was on about and people sort of nurturing, but the thing is he dies, he's a lot older though, and he dies, and then she's left with three children and has a good deal of trouble supporting herself and by having somewhere to live, but eventually finds a niche in the Blue Mountains. And you can get the sense that those, if McKee Wright had lived longer, who knows what her career might have been like.
Yes, you sort of, I think that he was her first reader and basically her first editor for a long period of time in the late teens, early 20s. And I think that made a big impact on her writing and her writing style, and I think for the better. It would have been good to be able to see what had happened if he had been able to last, but, you know, it's just one of those guys that basically is just going to die early from heart trouble, and she lasted through to the 1960s. But it's interesting that she was so popular back in the, so around the end of the First World War to about 1920, and then it just slowly faded. And now, if you were to ask most people, as I asked you, you know, you heard of, or you'd heard of her, but most people have got no idea who this woman is.
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of attention given to women poets in Australia, and so people have looked at Ada Cambridge's Book of Poetry. There's you know, Gwen Harwood, who's one of the best Australian poets. Judith Wright achieved superstar status. She was being referred to as an Australian living treasure while she was still alive, and that's correct. But looking back further, and I mean, Cross was very much part of the discourse against the world, against the effect of World War One in Australia and that whole conscription thing. And so she was very much on the pulse. Later, I think, as Australia grew more conservative, she was less on the pulse. I think she continued fairly radical. But you know, literary reputations, Australia has this terrible tendency to forget its own.
Except for those that end up on the school curricula, like, you know, Lawson and Patterson and, you know, Dorothy and McKellar's I Love a Sunburnt Country, which is the second verse rather than the first, which is what I find really peculiar. But there we go. But you get those ones that stand out. And she just, you know, maybe a lot of people thought, well, no, the stuff that she wrote wasn't really suitable for young, impressionable schoolgirls or schoolboys, and therefore it just didn't make it. And so slowly over the years, she just faded away.
It's entirely possible. And it didn't help that she was engaged for years writing this huge book about ancient Rome, which seems to have which never came out.
No, I don't know whatever happened to that. It doesn't. It just seems to have faded, and she just seemed to pick up on the that seemed to be the fashion at the time to write books about Rome. There are a couple that have been published serialized in the newspapers that I've come across, but I don't know whether they ever actually achieved book publication. Yeah. And I don't know, I haven't read through them all, I've just found them, and I don't know whether they would be really up to snuff.
Tastes have changed.
Yep.
And I think it's sort of like the modernist authors, like Eleanor Dark, Henry Handel Richardson, Christina Stead, who I remembered more as novelist, but I suspect her real métier was in poetry, that she was a poet born and bred. But just thinking about the structure of this book, one of the problems you have with the biographical approach is that most people, their lives taper towards the end; they become less interesting, or they're less active, and they, you know. Ursula Le Guin is an exception because she produced this Lavinia, which is a very fine book, when she's 80. And indeed, some writers can continue on into old age, but for others, they taper off, and she definitely tapers off. And I think that's a slight problem here, because you can't immediately say, oh, well, after this death, there was this resurgence of interest in her, because it wasn't. But, you know, this book does have a very good ending, and it's quoting work is a lovely bit of writing here. Work is the only way that I know to ease my restlessness. It makes me forget myself, and forgetting oneself is the secret of everything, isn't it? And that's the last line of the book, and that's a really great way of ending a book on. So, yes, it's a satisfactory read, and I would hope that it starts to turn up in the in the award listings, but
well,
who knows?
I think it's a really very very interesting approach, the way that she's done it, splitting it to show her relationships with people, because it basically gives you the indication that she lived through her relationships with people. She wasn't just on her own all the time, although in the end she became on her own. But all the way through her life, it was the relationships with other literary figures that was the thing of interest. So I think it comes out to be pretty good, and I agree that this should end up on a number of the awards lists this year, and I certainly hope that it does.
Yes, I agree.
Thanks very much, Lucy. Thank you. Right, from time to time on this podcast, we like to go back and have a look at something in the genre, a book or a film, which one of us really likes and the other one's not so happy with. In this case, we decided to have a look at a film, Interstellar, released in 2014, directed by Christopher Nolan. David and I discussed this. He absolutely and utterly hated it, as he recalled. I thought it was okay. I didn't think it was absolutely terribly spectacular, but I thought it was okay. And we thought we'd go back and have a look at it again, come up with our current views of it and see where they lie. So, David, have you changed your view about this particular film?
Well, it's interesting, actually. The answer is no. I still don't like it, with all sorts of reasons. And in fact, I'll be perfectly honest. My wife and I sat down to watch this about a year ago, and we got about 20 minutes in, and we both turned to each other and said, "Nah, we're not going to keep watching this." So when Perry suggested that we talk about it, I thought, "Well, I can take it. I'll make myself watch the whole thing again." So,
brave of you, David.
I'll explain the bit where we gave it up too, because it's probably important. But I'll recap the basic story if someone hasn't seen it very, very briefly. The Earth has had an environmental crisis. There's some sort of plant blight which has been killing off all the cereal crops and so on. A bit like The Death of Grass. There's a book called The Death of Grass, isn't there?
In the film, with the blight that is hitting all the crops, it's odd that they mention wheat and corn. They don't mention rice at all.
No, good point.
And I would be of the view that probably rice is more of a cereal crop than any other in the world.
That's right.
Maybe I'm wrong, but I think that's probably right.
It's American.
But given that this is set in the US, they just don't grow it.
That's it. So there's that part of it. So the big problem, therefore, is everyone's likely to starve. The only crop that seems to be surviving is at the moment is corn. And so everyone's got these huge, huge fields of maize. So Matthew McConaughey, who's this farmer, living in this little farmhouse, this sort of little rural-type farmhouse, and nevertheless has acres and acres and acres of corn growing. And he used to be an astronaut. As the movie starts, we find he's having a nightmare of something that happened to him when he was an astronaut, or a trainee to be an astronaut. But now all that's gone in the past, then we don't want to go into space anymore. The school books are now teaching kids that the moon landing was a hoax, and the focus on everybody is you've got to be a farmer. You've got to go out there and grow more crops. But weird things happen, and the main character Coop has a young daughter, and she finds really odd things happening in her room. And signals are being sent to her somehow. There's some sort of message being transmitted by what she calls a ghost in her room. And so eventually, we get to the bottom of this, and there's some sort of message which turns out to be the coordinates of some particular location, which is spelled out in binary in streaks of dust on the floor. Now, that's just about the point where I gave up, but no, I kept going. Anyway, he gets in his truck and he goes off to find what's at these coordinates, and his daughter sort of stows away on the track to go to the same place. The daughter is about 10 or 11, I think. And they discover that this is the last remaining outpost of NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration of America. And they're building this rocket ship that's going to go into space. There's already some sort of space station up there, but they're building this rocket to go up there again. And it turns out that Matthew McConaughey, the Coop, is the best possible pilot they could possibly have. And somehow, mysteriously, he's been recruited by forces unknown to come and take off. So I'm being very cynical about this. Anyway, then so there's been some sort of wormhole which has been placed in the solar system, and that connects to another galaxy, apparently. So there's something like 12 possible habitable worlds. And so they go there. So he goes up in the spaceship with a couple of other people like Anne Hathaway. they visit these various worlds, only three of which are real candidates, and various things happen to them. They're trying to find a suitable candidate for humanity to get into the stars and survive from Earth, because not only is the blight happening, but apparently this blight, which is killing off all the crops, is also absorbing all the oxygen, which is one thing, which is the other point at which I think I just about decided to give it away. Anyway, it's full of things which break your ability to believe, your suspension of disbelief. You kept hitting these roadblocks of, oh, I just can't believe that. You know, that I can't suspend my disbelief. This is terrible. And so it keeps on going, and that keeps on going. And then right at the end, it becomes incredibly sentimental and icky and over the top in terms of the amount of sentimentality in it. So I didn't like that either. So, and then there's the fact that these habitable worlds, three of these habitable worlds that they're visiting, are not in orbit around a star, but around a black hole. Now, it gives the director the chance to have this really nice-looking simulation of a black hole or visualization of a black hole. But black holes are not good places to be around. They emit gamma rays. They don't emit light that would be enough to grow crops in or anything like that. And so that's the other thing which sort of really just about got me. And well, the other thing about that is that one of the planets, the planet they visit first, is apparently very close to the event horizon. In fact, they say, someone says, and Miller's planet is on the horizon. Yes, as a basketball around a hoop. So this is supposed to be on the very event horizon, just outside the very event horizon of this black hole, at which point you wouldn't be able to see the black hole. All you'd be able to see is black, and you'd be surrounded by all the falling matter. So that was really annoying. And then there's the other bit where, you know, at the very start where he discovers NASA, they've got this Saturn V equivalent, you would agree. It looks like a Saturn V, and the whole spaceship takes off just like the Apollo astronauts took off and so on to get off the Earth. Now, they go visit this planet next to the black hole. And when they land on this planet, the surface gravity is about 1.5 that of the Earth, so it's got stronger surface gravity than the Earth. And yet they're able to get back into orbit in this little flyer. They don't need the Saturn V rocket anymore. They've got this little flying craft that's like a little space shuttle of its own. Without any boosters, it just flies up into space. So it's full of these things which really just got up my nose about the plausibility of this thing. And so, I don't know, it was a mess, I thought. It was just a mess. So what did you think, Perry?
Well, long ago, when I first watched this, long ago, like 4 or 5 years ago, I probably watched it when it first came out. I thought, oh, yeah, that was all right. It wasn't overly flash. I thought it was okay. And since I've gone back and had a look at it again, I've also gone to have a look at its reception in various web-based critical websites. IMDb, the Internet Movie Database, gives it 8.6 out of 10.
There you go. See, I'm obviously in the minority here.
Rotten Tomatoes gives it 7.06 out of 10. And Metacritic, which is a combination of a whole lot of either web-based or print-based reviews of a particular piece of work, gave it 74 out of 100. So they're all around that 74 to 80. I wouldn't give it any more than 5 out of 10.
No, no.
The first hour is just terrible. Bloody Matthew McConaughey, all he ever does is he talks in this whisper where he's trying to be really serious all the time. There is absolutely no emotion in his voice and he does not act. Michael Caine, he just plays Michael Caine. And all the way through, when I got to the end, I thought, you know, the only good actors in this whole film are the women. Either the young girl or the women.
Yeah, she's good.
They're all okay. Anne Hathaway's not great, but the other women in this are pretty good. The men are bloody...
The young girl is great.
The men are woeful. There's just nothing there. It's like, oh, God, I've got to walk through and I've got to read all this crap. And yeah, it's almost like they didn't want to be there. They really did not want to be there. So I started off with this idea that I was going to be arguing with you about how good this film was. And I said, I can't. Because and it's 2 hours and 49 minutes long.
Yeah,
it's long. Almost 3 hours.
Yeah.
Now, there's some nice touches in this here and there.
Yeah, I can mention a couple of things. Go on.
Yeah, there are a few things in it. And, you know, you really would have thought that somebody like Christopher Nolan would have done something pretty good out of all this material.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
he's the writer of things like Memento, The Dark Knight, Batman trilogy, Inception, Dunkirk. And he also directed films like Prestige with Robin Williams and Al Pacino, which is a fantastic thriller. I know it was a remake of something from Scandinavia. Still a fantastic thriller. And
sorry, what was
the oh, sorry, was that was the, Insomnia. And but he also Insomnia. Did Prestige, which is based on the Christopher Priest book.
Yeah, which is great.
So it's got a good pedigree. But I sat thinking about this after I watched it, and I reckon this is his homage to 2001.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things in this that if you take it as chunks, you take the first bit as a chunk where it's just basically trying to work out a reason to get these guys off the planet, really. That's what you want to do. That's all it is.
Yes.
A whole of the stuff is, as you say, is pretty sort of ridiculous and mindless. And so he just happens to be in the right place at the right time. They didn't know he was there, but he turns up. Oh, hi, you're here. Good. You're just the guy we're looking for. We can put you on a rocket and send you off. And you think, are you bloody kidding
you're the
me?
One.
So he basically, you know, it seems like a week after he's turned up at this place. He's suddenly on the spaceship. Guys take 2 years to bloody train themselves to basically get onto these things to know what to do. He's there flicking switches all over the place like he knows what's going on, and off he goes. All right, okay, get over that part, but just shut up, Perry. You just don't argue the toss about that. My son will go, well, just stop it. And then I just carried on, and I thought, okay. And then they go to this first planet, the one that's really right on the event horizon, and they're sitting there, and they're looking at this, and they land on the planet, and it's like half a meter of water in this planet. And they see something on the horizon, which they think are mountains, and then they realize, oh, it's a wave. And I thought, the first thing I thought of, have you never read Neutron Star by Larry Niven? Because that's the whole thing about he gets really close to a neutron star and he realizes that the thing that's pulling all the vessels apart and breaking everything up on the inside is the tidal forces that are stretching him from one side to the other.
Yeah.
And the same thing, this gigantic wave is a big tidal wave, not a tsunami, but it's a tidal wave because it's being pulled by the event horizon around the planet. And then I thought about that and I thought, hang on. It would take them take that planet about 2 weeks to get to the point where it was showing only one face to the to the event horizon anyway, and then you just have a big bulge. Where's the bloody wave coming from?
Yeah,
so I'm sitting there and I'm scratching my head and I'm thinking, and they're trying to get it. The music's going really loud and they're trying to make it really sort of action packed. And of course, you know, it's 5 years old, so we can tell them what happened. Somebody dies on the planet because somebody's stupid and they don't do the right thing. They send the woman goes off to try and get something instead of the robot. The robot runs out and gets her. Why did the robot go out and get it, I thought?
In the first place.
Again, I was the same as you. Every time something happens, I thought, hang on, why didn't they do that? The suspension of disbelief was just, no, it just wasn't there. And I thought it was really, it's very sad in this instance because they spent $165 million on this film.
Yeah. It could have been so much better.
Oh, much better. They could have had a better reason for getting off the planet and not spent an hour doing it.
Working up to it.
Yeah. I mean,
there are some good bits. There are some good bits in it. I mean, the thing which I did like about it was this whole concept of time running at a different rate when you're in a gravity well.
Yes.
And so when they go to the first planet, they're deep in the gravity well of this black hole. So time is actually running very much more slowly for them. Well, sorry, it's running fast outside of them and they're running slowly.
Yeah.
So they spend like an hour or something a couple of hours or something, and 23 years pass on the spaceship and on the Earth.
Yeah.
And so they go back to the spaceship and there's this poor guy that's been left. He's obviously a redshirt guy, by the way. Yep. He's the one who you know is going to get zapped at some point. He's been left on board the spaceship.
But hang on a minute. He's in a spaceship orbiting this planet. They're on the planet.
Yep.
And yep. The time dilation. Time dilation is caused by the black hole. Why isn't it affecting him as well?
Well, that's a good point, isn't it?
I didn't get that either.
But at least the concept of time running at different rates is interesting. And because Coop has kids on Earth, that's an interesting dynamic of the fact that they leave messages for him over this 23-year period.
One of the best.
They're getting older and older.
Probably the best part of the whole of the best part of the whole of the film, I think, was the indication that time is relative, and when you're going to come back, you're going to find out that you may well be younger than your children.
Yeah. Which is how it turns out
in the end. I just thought this was a golden opportunity for something to be done really well, and he basically messed it up. I don't know. The script is not very good. I gather he'd been working on this for 6 or 7 years. After 2 or 3 years, he should have realized he was on a hiding to nothing and chucked it out, and then got somebody else to write something for him. The thing about Kubrick is he at least had somebody with a sense of scientific and storytelling ability and Arthur C. Clarke to be able to help him along. Although 2001 is an obvious Kubrick film, you know, just that those long sequences. But they were fine. But you see a lot of I see a lot of echoes of 2001 in this film. When he goes towards the event horizons, that thing about going for the
going through the wormhole.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's a whole lot of that sort of stuff that goes on. Look, it's a very interesting film. It's worthwhile seeing. I don't think I'll ever watch it again. I can't see a single reason why I would watch that again. So.
No, I agree. I've got a million notes, but I'm not going to go through them all. There's so many things which get up my notes.
There's just so many things that were really annoying. Very few things that were really good. The good things were good, but the annoying things were really bloody annoying. And really it just annoying, dragged me out of the whole movie going experience. So I'm sitting there and think, and I struggled to finish it the second time around. I really did.
Yeah. Well, as I said, my wife and I stopped after the first 20 minutes or so. I think we certainly stopped before we got into orbit the first time. And I think one of the trigger points was those bloody ridiculous filing cabinet robots.
Oh, yeah.
What did you think of that?
Oh, I actually didn't mind them. The one thing, I didn't mind the robots themselves because I like the way they were able to adapt, fit into different parts to take over, to slot into a slot where they could act as the main AI in the space shuttle. What I didn't understand was why has it got a small little bloody screen on the front of the robot?
Exactly.
With all the text coming through. What about you, David?
Yeah, that's right.
But when I sit on my laptop and I'm sitting there, I don't see a little screen in the corner with all the text running through for all the code being run.
Why do they keep doing this?
I mean, do they think we're idiots?
I mean the robot in Moon was equally non-anthropomorphic, but it's a lot more fun.
Yeah.
You remember the little smiley screen on. Had a little screen with a smiley face that changed emotions on. It was very clever.
That was fine. That was perfect.
Okay,
I can deal with that because that's quirky and funny. But putting this stuff here, I mean, I actually was listening for a while because I wanted to hear sort of like the teletype text going as the lines of code went across the screen because I thought that's the only thing that's missing.
We've trashed it enough, I think, don't you?
I think we have. Let's not go back to that one again. Good to see it, but no.
Yeah, so next time around we'll have to find a film which we actually disagree on, one that one of us likes and the others dislikes. So we'll have a think about what
we will. We'll do that. So David, I think that finishes us up for this particular episode.
It does.
We've got a fair bit in here that we've covered. We've come to the end of our time. We're probably well over the hour. We've got a few things coming up. The listener may be interested to know that next episode we will be giving over the whole of the episode to discussing the Hugo nominees for the 1961 awards. This is work that was published in 1960. The novels, five of which were on the shortlist, are all very interesting works, and a lot of the short fiction is also very interesting, and to the extent that we are going to try and get through the whole lot of all of it, of the short fiction and all of the novels, and so we'll be discussing those as throughout the whole of that episode, and that'll take over all of that. And then we also have a long interview with the proprietors of a small Melbourne-based genre small press that was around in the 1970s, and that'll be coming up in a couple of weeks. That's an interview we've got in the can, and we've got a number of ideas for a few other things. So
we do.
A bit coming up, David, a bit coming up.
Quite a bit. No shortage of material, that's for correct. Sure.
All right. Thanks, David. We shall see you next time.
Okay, thank you.
We've got a lot of things to talk about then. See ya.
Excellent. See you then. Okay. Thanks, Barry.
Bye.